Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, H.C. Felder, and today the topic is an evaluation of theistic evolution, and I have with me to discuss this my special guest, Dr. William Dembski. Let me tell you about Dr. Dembski. He holds doctorates in both mathematics and philosophy. He is professor of science and culture at Southern Evangelical Seminary, where I graduated from with my master's and currently working on my doctorate. He has authored or edited 20 books, including his first book on intelligent design titled The Design Inference. He lectures widely on intelligent design and has appeared on numerous radio and television programs. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dembski.
Good to be with you, H.C.
All right. Well, let's get to it, Dr. Dembski. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I was telling you a little earlier that I've done a number of shows on intelligent design. But I had no idea that I would have one of the members of the design movement in my studio. So I thought I'd talk with you about something, I guess, related to intelligent design, but something that you may have more insight to than some other people. So I wanted to talk to you today about a theistic evolution. I've never done a show on that, and I think it's a very interesting topic. I think a lot of people are confused by it, so I want to clear up some of that confusion. So I would like to start off by just asking the question of what is theistic evolution?
Right. I mean, if you go to most Christian colleges in the United States, they're not going to be teaching creationism or intelligent design. And they, insofar as they teach evolution, which they will, they want to put a theistic slant on it. So basically, what's taught there is the straight up, what's called neo-Darwinian synthesis. It's the textbook orthodoxy. It's what you're going to find in all the secular biology textbooks. But then it's going to be given, as it were, a veneer, a theological veneer, which is that God did it that way. So it's basically taking a secular materialistic theory of evolution and just saying that's the way God did it. So in terms of the science, there's absolutely no difference from the science of Richard Dawkins. I mean, Richard Dawkins will say something like, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of being designed for a purpose. And he's going to say, but there's really no design there. There's no, God didn't have anything to do with it. It's just a purely material process. Theistic evolutionist would say, well, from the vantage of science, we can't see any divine handiwork, but we know on theological grounds that God still worked it all out. Okay? And so it's kind of a halfway house between, you know, traditional Christian theism, which sees God as very actively involved in creating the world, in which God actually does miraculous things in bringing about life. I mean, that's the traditional view. And this purely secular, materialistic view, which says God, intelligence had nothing to do with it. So it's, in a sense, you're able to keep your peace with the scientific community because you're saying what God did, he did it as a master of stealth, so our science can never speak to that. And then when you're wearing your Sunday school hat, you know, it's like, well, I'm just doing this as a scientist, but you know, I still believe that God created everything. It's just that he didn't do it in a way where we can do any science with it. Now, as a logical possibility, that could be, but the real question is, what's the evidence for this secular materialistic evolutionary theory? And I would say it's very minimal. It's there are basically two things or three things going on with evolutionary theory. I mean, it's, you've got a claim about organisms being related by some sort of the organisms are transforming one into another, and there's this great tree of life. Okay, so, and the thing is, so there's a microevolutionary claim that things are gradually changing. And the thing is, organisms do change. I mean, you know, parents look different from their children. So there's some change that's happening. But the thing is, they're saying that these sorts of small changes, when you extrapolate them far enough, lead to huge changes. So that bacteria will eventually evolve into things like us, you know, so monad to man evolution. But the other claim is that this all happens by purely unguided naturalistic process, natural selection acting on random variations. And that's what the materialistic theory says. And the theistic evolutionists are going to say, well, but God is still kind of behind that, only we can't see it. We can't see what God's activity is. Now, as I said, as a logical possibility, that could be, but the question is, what's the evidence? And the evidence for a purely material process being able to produce all the living forms that we see, I would say, is very minimal. I mean, you know, you're sitting on an intelligent design class that I'm teaching at SES right now,
right.
And we're going through that. So, from my vantage as an intelligent design person, theistic evolution is a solution to a problem that no longer exists. I mean, the problem for theistic evolution is how do we reconcile a materialistic science, which seems to say that God has nothing to do with creation and especially the creation of life, and what the Bible and what theology is taught. And so they're kind of taking a kludge of these views and saying, well, the evolutionary theory works, but God still somehow did it. You know, and we're saying, well, that evolutionary theory fails on its own terms. The evidence simply does not support it. I mean, what do I mean by that, you know, that the evidence doesn't support it? Well, I think there's some key places where evolutionary theory fails and fails abysmally. One case was something that Darwin was aware of. He thought that eventually the problem would go away, but if anything, it's become worse. And this is the problem of the Cambrian explosion. If you look in the fossil record, evolutionists are very fond of saying that the fossil record completely vindicates their theory, but in fact, there's some grave problems there. And one of the biggest is in the what's called the Cambrian explosion. This is a fossil stratum, you know, by conventional dating goes back 550 million years or so. And in that stratum, you have all these basic animal body plans that suddenly appear. Basic animal body plans, you know, we have the same sort of body plan as an ape and even as a deer mm-hmm. and mouse. I mean, you know, we've got the hard stuff on the inside, the skeleton, you know, got a backbone. You know, it's the same sort of body plan. We look very different, but the body plan that we have is going to be much, much different from, let's say, a lobster, where you've got the hard stuff on the outside and the soft stuff on the inside, or a starfish or a worm. And so when we're talking body plans, we're talking about these very radically different types of bodily structures, starfish, worms, right. lobsters, humans. And the thing is, all those basic body plans emerge suddenly in this Cambrian stratum, and there are no evolutionary precursors that we find. I mean, there are a few things we find, some sponge embryos, maybe some worm tracks, but they basically just poof, there they are. And the thing is, if Darwin is right, there should be all these precursors to it, and they're not there. And the thing is, so you could say, well, the fossil record just is incomplete. It didn't record all of that. But the thing is, the fossil record seems to be actually very good at recording things. And you can tell that because you just look at fossilization percentages of existing fossils. And you say, okay, how much of the stuff that we see presently gets fossilized? And a lot of the stuff gets fossilized. Especially when you go to higher levels of classification, you can have 80-70% fossilization rates. So it really, so I'm just giving you like one line of evidence why this theory of evolution, which the mainstream Christian academy has bought into, I mean, places like Wheaton College, Calvin College, Seattle Pacific University, Westmont, they're all thoroughly theistic evolutionist. Wow. And so, you know, for many of these schools, I mean, you know, I've got kids that are going to be going to college in the next few years. Most Christian colleges, I would not, you know, not want to send my kids there because I think they've really sold out to this materialistic way of looking at things.
I had no idea that Christian colleges were teaching that. I mean, oh, yeah. I think I was aware that some of the bigger, more major universities, such as your old alma mater, Baylor, mm-hmm. I was aware that. Well, do they even teach theistic evolution, or do they just teach evolution?
Well, the thing is, in the biology departments at these schools, it is just going to be straight up evolution.
Okay.
But the thing is, then if you're going to be a Christian about it or try to make some sort of reconciliation with it. I mean, Richard Dawkins, you know, he's one of my favorite whipping boys. I mean, he's going to say that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, okay? Right. Many atheists are looking to Darwin to justify their theory. Christopher Hitchens, I debated him before his death. He's a well-known atheist. He wrote a book, God is Not Great. Okay, he's a literature guy, okay? He was not a scientist. He's got a book, you know, God is Not Great, 350 pages, something like that. He's got a full chapter on evolution and against design. Now, what's that doing in a book, you know, on atheism? Well, it's because right. they need a justification. The atheism we're looking at is a scientific atheism. It's looking to science to justify the atheism.
Right.
Okay, so that's what we're looking at. And so the theist, when you're talking theistic evolutionists, if you're a theist and you believe that evolution happened, then you have to somehow say that God did it that way.
Right.
You know, and
right.
so the theism, notice it's the adjective. I mean, it's not the noun is evolution. Okay, that's where the action is. But the theism is just a gloss. I mean, there's atheistic evolution and there's theistic evolution. And it's just how you're interpreting it. But the theory itself is the same. And when you look at the theory, What it's saying is that there is this, there's natural selection, which is acting on some sort of random variations. Those variations, usually these days, they're conceived as random or genetic mutations, so really copying errors in DNA. So there's no sign of intelligence in that. And then natural selection, that's an instant gratification mechanism which says, what's going to help the organism right now? If it's not helping me, well, we're going to weed you out. If it right. is, we're going to keep you.
Right.
And so that's this mechanism. And, you know, it's a trial and error mechanism. And trial and error, we know, in human practice only goes so far. So if trial and error is able to create us, you know, what need is there for God?
Right.
Okay, for that's the line that many atheistic evolutionists take. And many people who lose their faith, that's what actually drives them to that.
Right,
if you've
right.
There's a wonderful video by Lee Strobel. He wrote this book, Case for the Creator, and then there's a video, which is I think has the same name, where he describes how he lost his faith at age 14 because he thought that there were some experiments which showed that life could organize itself from non-living matter.
Right.
You know, so the thing is, in a sense, none of this stuff about chemical evolution, how life could form from inorganic matter, or biological evolution, how more complex life forms can emerge from simpler life forms, none of that disproves, strictly speaking, in a strict logical sense, that that God exists. But it all seems to render God unnecessary.
Right.
You know? And that's what I think ends up being very persuasive to the atheists. That's why they keep pushing evolutionary theory. And the theistic evolutionary position then is really kind of a holding strategy. We're gonna, you know, we're gonna go with the atheists as far as we can on their science, but we're still gonna believe in God. For what reasons? Well, you know, there can be other reasons for believing in God, but it's not gonna be on the basis of the science. And
okay.
And from the vantage of the intelligent design community, which is where I move and live, you know, we see that there is good evidence for design in biology. I mean, intelligent design is the study of patterns in nature best explained as the product of intelligence. So we look at these biological systems and we see, for instance, in the DNA, it's probably the best information storage and retrieval system that's around in terms of just how compact it is, how reliable it is. It's a remarkable system,
yeah.
You know, and we've been inventing these systems right along, and now we look in the cell and we find that we've got something even better than what we've invented, and that seems to me remarkable. We have to be software and design engineers to understand what's going on in the cell, and then when we look in the cell, we find engineering of a level that's way beyond anything that we as humans have come up with. So that's why I say I see theistic evolution as a solution to a problem that really no longer exists. We don't need to go there with evolution because it's a theory that's a 19th century theory which had at the time and still has no real concept of the information problems that face biology.
Right. Oh, I have an evangelical Christian, Francis Collins, who is a theistic evolution, mm-hmm. and I came across his work because he required it in the class.
<That's right.
laughs> But he made a couple of points as to demonstrate why theistic evolution is true. One of the things he talks about is pseudogenes. Mm-hmm. And if I understand him correctly, basically what he's saying is that in the DNA script, there are certain corruptions.
Mm-hmm.
And we see those corruptions in the DNA of chimpanzees, those same corruptions in the DNA of chimpanzees as we see in man. Now, a creator who is a good designer, why would he create man with the same genetic corruptions that are carried from chimpanzees? In his view, it makes more sense that man evolved from chimpanzees, which will explain, in his view, better the corruptions in the DNA mm-hmm. that we find in man.
Right. Yeah, this sort of junk DNA argument, pseudogenes are supposed to be a form of junk DNA. It's a gene or something that looks like a gene that actually is functional that will code for a protein, but there's some change in it which then renders it incapable of doing that. The problem with that, these arguments, and these junk DNA arguments generally, there's also a lot of repetitive DNA, you know, so there's the view had been, until very recently, that much of the DNA in humans and other organisms is totally useless, and that basically it's been strung along by a sloppy evolutionary process
right.
because it was easier just to keep copying it along rather than editing it out. Okay, so the term junk DNA has been around about 40 years. The problem is that we now know that most of this junk DNA actually is functional. Okay, I mean, so this is, my colleagues and I, we've been saying that we should be looking for function in this. Because how do you know that something isn't functional? You know, right, you might say, right, here's a mouse trap, let's remove the hammer. Okay, well, now I can't squash mice, but I can use that mouse trap as a doorstop. You know, there are other things that it could be serving as. So the thing is, just because we're saying, to say that something is non-functional, that's a very strong claim. It means that for all, everything that it might be doing, it can't succeed in doing it. And there's no, so it's actually a very strong claim. And it's increasingly being found that what is regarded as junk is actually not junk. How do we know that? I mean, one way we know it is that virtually all of the DNA in us and other organisms gets copied into messenger RNA. So the cell is using an enormous amount of energy to copy it and recopy all this stuff, you know, that's in our DNA. Why is it doing that? Okay, so but the thing is, it gives us at least some indication if the cell is expending that much energy, there's got to be some function that this is serving. But then we can also find particular functions. And with pseudogenes, for instance, it's often these pseudogenes have a role in either enhancing or facilitating gene expression. So thing is, we're finding more and more more functions for these things. But the real kicker is, I mean, the book that you were citing was The Language of God, Francis Collins. Mm-hmm. That was written in 2006. He's repudiated junk DNA since then. So in his 2008 or 2010 book, The Language of Life, he no longer goes there. He himself has recognized that that junk DNA isn't junk. You know, he hasn't come out as publicly as he might have. Right. But there are people still pushing that line. But it's if you really want to see what's going on in this debate, read Jonathan Wells's The Myth of Junk DNA, where he just goes through the whole literature and shows that that's what was regarded as junk. I mean, previously it was thought that in humans, coding DNA, the useful DNA was only about 1.5%, 1.5% of human DNA. Now, people think it's much, much more, you know, 95%.
Well, there's something similar that he talks about. Now, some of the writing is a little technical, so forgive me if I'm incorrect in the way that I state this. But he talks about these genetic switches, and he talks about the fact that we all have these switches, but some are turned on in certain species and some are turned off. He gives a good example that there's a genetic switch that, when turned on, is turned on in humans, allows us the ability to speak, to be able to use complicated grammatical sentences, and to be able to think on a higher level. Now, that exact same switch is available in chimpanzees and other species, but for some reason it's turned on in man. So his idea is that why even have these switches if they're not even turned on in other species? So his thinking is that these are switches that were just carried from one species to another, and as we evolve, our species was the species that had these switches turned on, which makes us different. The only thing that makes us different is that these switches were turned on, and that DNA is a better explanation than a creator who would have these scripts of these switches in all these different species, but not being turned on.
Yeah. Well, what to say there? I mean, the thing is, bodily similarity between chimpanzees or primates and humans, that's been known for however long. I mean, Linnaeus, when he was doing classification, he saw that basically just about any muscle, any bone that we have was there in chimpanzees or other primates. So the thing is, it's really no surprise that we're going to have, that there's going to be a lot of genetic similarity between us and these other other primates. So what is the difference? Now, I think to say that, you know, that there's a switch, I don't, it's been a while since I've read the book, so I don't recall it being put in terms of switches. But there is, chimpanzees, I think, even have a little bit more DNA than we do. So it seems that whatever is going on is not just in terms of some sort of like physical quantity that can be, you know, given a precise number, that's going to be a difference maker. Somehow, our features and how we're coordinated, you know, how our physical characteristics are coordinated, is allowing for this intelligence, a massive amount of intelligence to be expressed in us, which is not there in chimps. I mean, our language ability, people have, for instance, pushed for the idea that chimps can have language ability. Well, it's very, very limited what they have. I mean, they don't have the sort of universal grammar that we have, and the facility with concepts, abstractions, and all of that. So, from my vantage as a Christian, you know, I'm not a materialist, so I don't see who we are. Our personal identity is ultimately being tied to our physical being. We're going to transcend that being and when we're resurrected. So that's why, you know, just to say, well, there are these similarities, and, you know, and if we just had a switch, well, then it certainly wouldn't be the case. If there's some switch, then the chimpanzees can suddenly be talking or something like that. There's no, I mean, you know, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see the experimental evidence for that, you know. So please, you know, do your experiments and let's show us that. But this idea that there's the similarity, you know, I don't find that particularly challenging or threatening. Now, the similarity, do we read that as a sign of evolution, that we've evolved from apes? My own view is that I don't buy that, because it seems to me, you know, I've had too much experience with design where you take an existing design and then you want to transform it into another thing. Take a house, for instance. You know, it's usually much easier just to scrap it and start a new design rather than try to rebuild an existing design. So I see very limited evolution. I don't see it having, I think it's much more interspecies, intergenus, and I don't see it as going, I don't believe that humans, for instance, descended from apes. But there are intelligent design people who do, you know, who see, but that's a question of design implementation. The theistic evolutionist, though, is going to be totally committed to the Darwinian story of universal common ancestry and everything being related to everything else, and that it happens by a process of natural selection acting on seemingly random variations. And that's, intelligent design, we have a lot of options in terms of how this might have happened, and we're still working those out. The theistic evolutionist, though, is basically an unreconstructed evolutionist who then tries to put a theistic veneer on things.
Yeah, and getting to that, I want to talk about this, because this is very important. What is the compatibility between theistic evolution and the Bible? I don't hear, when I read Francis Collins, he sort of glosses over the whole Adam and Eve thing, because there's an incompatibility there that I don't hear them talking about.
Yeah. Well, and I think they do gloss over it, because on the one hand, Collins and his people at BioLogos and there's a whole movement of theistic evolutionists, which is much more militant than it used to be. Which is trying to convince young people that, hey, come on board with theistic evolution, because, you know, this is the only way to have biblical credit. This is the only way to have credibility as a thinking Christian. Okay, right. And I've heard it put. Daryl Falk at BioLogos, this is the organization that Francis Collins founded. He said this is a missional issue for him. Missional in what sense? Well, we can't do missions. We can't evangelize people if we're not going to be good evolutionists, is basically what he's saying, because otherwise, we don't have credibility with the culture at large. We can't speak to them in a credible way. Now, I don't buy that at all, you know. But the thing is, you raise the good point. Well, I mean, what do you do with theistic evolution? How do you relate it to scripture, exegesis, traditional, sound Christian theology? And I think it's a hard sell, you know.
Yeah,
there's a lot of tension there. I mean, all the theistic evolutionists I know reject a historical Adam and Eve.
Right.
Okay, so so that seems to go by the board. And it seems that lots of things, I mean, you know, how do you read Genesis, you know, as an evolutionist? You know, I mean, I have a hard enough time as an old Earth creationist. I mean, I'm not a young Earth creationist, but, you know, that's why I wrote a book called The End of Christianity. But it's, from a theistic evolutionist, you know, what distinguishes humanity, you know, and at some point it seems what you're going to have to do if you're going to be a theistic evolutionist and still try to preserve something like the image of God, you're going to have to say at some point when a human evolved from an ape-like ancestor, God specially breathed into them this breath of life, or put the image in, because the image wasn't there in the primate.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And once you're doing that, in a sense, you defeat the whole purpose of evolution, which is to give a purely naturalistic account of how we got here.
Well, and not only that, it sort of defeats the Bible makes no sense if theistic evolution is true. And here's what I'm getting at. If there was no Adam and Eve, then there was no fall. If there was no fall, there is no sin. If there's no sin, what is the point of Jesus? And when we look at Jesus, Jesus talks about Adam and Eve as literal people. Mm. What did Jesus come to save us from if there was no fall?
Well, but the interesting thing is some of the theistic evolutionists now, one person who's more on the fringes there, he's no longer with Biologos, a guy named Carl Giberson, he wrote a book called Saving Darwin. Now, you might ask yourself, why would you want to save Darwin? But he wrote that book because he was trying to address the evangelicals. He himself started out as a young earth creationist years back, and he basically redefines sin and everything. So he'll say that our sin is that we are the result of a selfish evolutionary process, and that's basically what our sinfulness is. It's a product of evolution. We're selfish. We're seeking our own best, you know, to reproduce ourselves and this. And so our salvation then is to be released from, you know, as it were, the effects of evolution. I mean, it's a weird sort of thing, but then he has to completely redefine sin. So rather than sin being conscious rebellion against the commands of a God, you know, who has our best interests at heart, it becomes, you know, this feature of our evolutionary past. And so he has to redefine it. And I think that's what you have to do. You have to basically, sin doesn't become sin in the traditional sense if you're gonna follow the logic of this.
And I noticed that all cults do that. Not only do all cults do that, other religions do that. And I think they all have the same author, and this is the same author as the one who was with Adam and Eve in the garden, and that is the actual originator of lies. And Dr. William Dembski, believe it or not, that has brought us to the end of the show.
Okay.
And I really want to thank you for being
thank
on the show.
You for
We've been
you.
Here today talking about or giving an evaluation of theistic evolution, and that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time, and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes, by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org. Father,